We've already taken time this morning to celebrate and worship the God of power. And we're continuing on in our series on the theme of fire throughout the scriptures. Last week we talked about the fire of God's glory. This morning we're going to talk about the fire of God's power. Now the issue of power is one that raises a lot of concerns on one side, a lot of joy on the other, a lot of mixed thoughts and emotions. Especially when you come to this issue of God's miraculous power. Different people even within Christendom come from different places in their understanding of that. I want you to imagine somebody who is growing up in the middle of the desert and who has never been exposed to any media, and they hear somebody describe the ocean. It would be very, very difficult for them to understand or to comprehend the ocean. And that's understandable. In likewise manner, if you grew up or somebody grew up on the flatlands, hundreds of miles as far as you could look other way, it was always flat. And every trip they ever took was always on flatland. It would be very difficult for them, if they had not been exposed to media and pictures, to imagine, to try and comprehend the Himalaya Mountains or the Rocky Mountains or some huge mountain range. And that would be understandable. In like manner, it's very understandable when some people have difficulty comprehending the miraculous power of God. If you have never been exposed to it, if you have never seen it, if you have never personally encountered it, even if somebody else describes it, it's understandable why you may have some questions about that. Or some, I don't know, is this hocus pocus? Is this just fairy tale or folklore? That's understandable. Some of you may be here today like that. And if you have those doubts and those questions, I can understand that you may come from that position. I never had that luxury. My first encounter with the fire of God's power took place when I was only 10 years of age. As some of you know, my family background is my parents came to faith in Christ out of a very raunchy, pagan background. My father was an alcoholic, one of the largest distributors of home brew in southern Saskatchewan. He had the still in his garage for some of you. And he was a fighter. I remember the wild, drunken brawls at our house. It was just, that's how I grew up. But at 10 years of age, my mom and dad had a powerful encounter with God. They gave their lives to Jesus Christ. He came into their hearts, transformed them, made their marriage new, our home new. God miraculously healed my dad's body physically and delivered him entirely from alcoholism. A series of miracles happened in his life. As a result, my dad had no trouble whatsoever from that point on believing God. If God said something, he simply believed it and he acted on it and saw God's power continue in our family. A couple of months after this encounter with Christ, Dad was out. It was a beautiful autumn day, harvest season. The crops had gotten ripe for harvest, and Dad, being a very clean farmer, wanted to burn up the weeds in the ditch along the county road by his farm. And so he was out there in the ditches and burning up the weeds. It was a perfect calm autumn day when all of a sudden a little prairie twister came across the summer fallow, came right into his fire, picked up a bunch of the burning leaves, took it across the road into a ripe hay field. And as if the demons began to blow, a gust of wind came up and just poof, that hay field went into flames. The winds picked up and that whole field started to go up in flames. Now, my dad knew that the whole area, that part of the countryside, all the farmers beside him, all had ripe hay fields. He knew this was a big disaster in the making. So he got back to the house as quick as he could. He got his big case tractor and his double-discer plow, hooked it up, and headed down for halfway through the field and began plowing across, making a fire break. And he made it all the way across the field, turned it around, was coming down the second time to make it wide enough, hopefully to stop the fire. But by the time he got to the middle of the field, the fire had already jumped both sides of his fire break, ahead of him, behind him, had circled around him, and was closing in on him from all sides. The flames, he said, were 15 feet in the air, licking the sky, and he knew death was imminent. My father had only one option. He simply, as he describes it, he said, I put my arm on the steering wheel and my head on my arm, and I cried out, oh, God, help me. And as Dad describes it, when he lifted his face from his arm, not only were there no more flames, there was not even smoke. He came back to the house and he got my older brother and I and my mom and we went down to that place in the farm, in the field, where I could see the black scorched earth all around where his tractor had stopped plowing. And I listened to my dad tell that story. And as a 10-year-old boy, I knew instantly there is a God who's bigger than fire. This morning we come to another story of God and fire, but this time God doesn't stop a fire. He actually lights one. Again, showing that fire is but a tool in his hand. 1 Kings 18 tells the story. I trust you will allow me to summarize it and simply highlight the key passages. And I encourage you, if you haven't read 1 Kings 18 prior to today, please go home and read the whole chapter. God will speak to your heart with some of the other details that I'm overpassing. The story takes place during King Ahab's rule. Ahab was one of the wickedest kings that Israel had. His wife Jezebel, her name becoming synonymous with evil, these two together formed this ultimate tag team of evil in the land. It was under their oversight that the worship of Baal was promoted and increased, and along with this, temple prostitution and child sacrifice, because these were part and parcel of their worship experience. The word Baal means master or owner or lord, and it was used in a number of different ways, but when it came to their god Baal, it was many times in many Phoenician and Canaanite shrines of the day, Baal worship referred to the fertility aspect. He was their fertility god, which explains a lot of their immoral actions as part of their worship. He was also the sun god or the god of fire. I find that very, very interesting, especially in light of our story. Well, hard times hit the country. A 3-year drought had produced a famine throughout the land, and obviously this had hurt the economy seriously. Ahab, as leader of the land, needing an excuse for why his political career was going down the tubes, pointed to the religious leaders and said to Elijah and the other priests and prophets of the Lord, "It's your fault." And so he rounded up a bunch of them and killed them to flex his muscle and show that he really was in charge. But Elijah, on the other hand, turned the tables on Ahab and accused him and his family of being the source of all the social ill and downfall of their society because he had rejected the Lord and had turned to idols. Now, you can imagine a political leader of any stature in the world having some religious guy walk into his office, point the finger and say, "You're the problem in the land." Well, Ahab was livid. He was furious. And so he sought to have Elijah's head. He looked all over for him, but couldn't find him. God kept hiding him, in a sense. Well, the prophet Elijah finally stepped out of the shadows and invited King Ahab to a duel, to a contest, to a fight. But his strategy of how he went about it is really, really strange. He told Ahab to round up the prophets of Baal and meet him on top of Mount Carmel. Now, Mount Carmel was one of the primary high places of worship for Baal. It's like picking a fight with somebody and then asking if you can go into their backyard with their friends and neighbors cheering them on, and that's where you're going to fight. Elijah was putting himself at a very distinct disadvantage. It was 450 prophets of Baal on one side and Elijah on the other. To make matters worse, as you read the story, after they set up their sacrifices, Elijah had his sacrifice completely doused with water so that all the wood and all the sacrifice and all the altar were so wet it would have been near impossible to burn. Now you say, why in the world would he set it up such a way? Why would he put himself in such an impossible circumstance? Well, the reason is because we have an enemy. He knew that he had an enemy. And he knew that each one of us have an enemy. But the enemy is to engage. You see, dear friends, if we want to experience the fire of God's power in our lives, you don't just identify the enemy, you have to engage them. But you won't engage the enemy without a confidence that you can win. Do you know anybody who goes out to pick a fight knowing they're going to get the tar beat out of them? Nobody does that. We only fight if we think we can win. And I have a strong hunch that one of the reasons why many professing Christians never move beyond what I would call kindergarten faith or grade one Christianity. You may have accepted Jesus, you may know you're going to heaven when you die, but that's where it stops. The rest of your life is lived in your own power. The reason why many people never move from there into supernatural dynamic encounter with God regularly is because underlying our assumptions of God is this sneaking suspicion that God is weak. And that if we really get into the hard times, if we really get into the battle, if we really take God at His word, He's going to drop us like a rock. And He won't come through. And because we have a low view of God, it limits our experience of God's power. Your concept of God has a direct bearing on your experience of Him. And it always will. Let me ask you this morning, who is your enemy? There you go. Who is your enemy? Elijah had his, but who is yours? Now be careful. Most of us immediately think of another person who has hurt us, or taken from us, or spoken against us, or avoided us, or blocked us, or just been nasty. We think of those people. Does anybody here have somebody like that in your life? Well, there's one person back there. Anybody else? Well, yeah, we all do. Everybody has people like that in our lives. The history of the church, unfortunately, is peppered with situations where people thought that they were called by God to hurt other people in God's name. Unfortunately, sometimes Christians have felt that other religious people from other religions are the enemy. They're not. They're not. God forgive us for the way that those in the name of God, in the name of Jesus, have taken and hurt people or wounded or pushed people aside or killed them. God forgive us. People are not the enemy. They are victims of the enemy. Where are we here? There you go. People are not the enemy. They are victims of the enemy. Next time you encounter somebody who is giving you hassle in your life, ask God to give you the eyes to look past the individual and see what's going on behind the scenes. Many times the people who provide most hassle to you in your life are simply acting out the own pain of their own heart, their own upset, their own insecurities. They're taking it out on you. Look past the hurt. Look past what they're doing to you and find out what's going on in their life. And you will often see circumstances that desperately need the love of God to touch their heart. You will also sometimes see a manipulation from the enemy of their soul and the enemy of ours, who's manipulating them to try and get at you. You see, the number one thing the devil tries to do is to limit your view of God. And what happens when he uses trouble in our lives, we're faced with trouble, we're faced with difficulty, with people who are in our face, what happens? We immediately focus on those people, on those problems. And we get so wrapped up in those earthly things that our view of God comes down to this level, and then we wonder why life is so ugly. Satan scores every time he can use enemies, so to speak, earthly human enemies, to lower our view and to get our view off of him. So who's your enemy? People, say this with me. People are not the enemy. They are victims of the enemy. Let that sink into your heart. Because when it does, it will revolutionize how you begin to treat other people. The Apostle Paul said, "We are not fighting against humans. We are fighting against forces and authorities and against rulers of darkness and powers in the spiritual world." That's where our battle is. When we understand that the battle we face is not human but is of a spiritual nature, it completely changes the approach to how we fight. For example, if you're in a financial fight, you better have more money than the guy you're fighting. If you're in an intellectual debate, you better know the subject better than your opponent. If you want a physical fight, make sure that your muscles are stronger and better prepared than the other guy. In a similar way, if you're entering a spiritual fight, you must know, as the Apostle Paul did, that greater is he who is in us than he who is in the world. If you don't know that, you'll never engage the enemy. Greater is he who is in us. Who is that? Who is that? Jesus. If you've invited Christ to come into your life, you have the eternal, almighty creator of the universe dwelling inside of you. And if he's powerful enough to do all of that, and as we created earlier, able to sustain the entire universe by the power of his word, if he can do that, if this God is in you, greater is he who is in us than he who is in the world. Until you know that, you'll never engage the enemy. But when you know it, you're ready to fight. Fight spiritually and get ready for victory. That's where our fight is. Elijah had that kind of confidence. He didn't care at all if they assembled thousands of false prophets, for he knew that the Lord really was who the Lord really was, and it was no contest. And so the question is not who is your enemy, but who is your God? That's the ultimate question. You see, as we look at the difficulties that we're up against, whether they are problems with people or finances or health or direction or relationships or something else in our life, this is the ultimate question. Not what are you facing? As long as you focus on the problem, as long as you focus on the issue, that's the level that you dwell at. But when you lift your eyes to who your God is, it transfers this thing to a whole new level, a whole new plane. When Ahab and the prophets of Baal showed up on Mount Carmel, Elijah asked them, "How long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, then follow him." Please notice that Elijah did not come in with some spiritual whip and forcing people to observe certain laws or do certain things. He didn't say, "You have to worship. You have to worship this way. You have to dress this way. You have to do..." No. I don't know where Christians get this, where we try and put each other in each other's boxes. God created you with a free will, dear friend, and you have a responsibility to exercise that free will. You'll be able to blame nobody on Judgment Day that they made me or they didn't make me. You have a free will. The choice is yours. And Elijah said, "Take a choice. Take a choice. You have a chance to choose, and you have a chance to choose today. Choose. Choose wisely." Choice is something that God gives to every one of us. And the choice that we make determines, or tells at least, the story of who it is that we're worshiping. Every single day, we are faced with the same choice that Ahab had to make. We either choose the Lord to be our God, or we choose something or someone else. Some people say that they're not really choosing against God. They're just not ready to choose for him. Now, that sounds intellectually safe, but friends, put that in any other arena and listen to how silly it sounds. You hear the conductor say, "All aboard," and you stand there on the train platform considering whether or not you should get on the train, not deciding for and not deciding against. As the train pulls away, you made your choice. The train is gone. You're in the water. You're drowning. Keeping your nose above. You've been down once. You've been down twice. This will be your last time. And somebody throws you a life rope. It's there. It's right beside you. You say, "Should I take it or shouldn't I take it? I don't know. I'm not going to make a choice." You made your choice. You drown. After the service, somebody walks up to you, invites you out for lunch. "Come, enjoy lunch with us." "Well, let me think about it." And you take a day to think about it. You go home hungry. You made your choice. Dear friends, not making a choice is a choice. And every single time you choose not to follow God, not to worship God, not to have God as first place in your life, you're making a choice, and the choice is against him. That's as simple as I can say it. And that's simply what Elijah faced Ahab and the prophets of Baal with. Make a choice. Don't pretend that you're... Quit vacillating. Declare whose side you're on. Declare which God you're really going to serve. See, every single day you and I choose who we are going to serve. If you've not chosen to serve God, you're already serving another or more than one gods in your life. Something else has captivated your loyalty, your passion, and your focus. Something else is establishing your priorities. Something else is determining your pleasures, directs how you spend your time, your talents, and your treasures. You are already serving one or more gods, one or more lords, one or more Baals in your life. You have already made those choices, and so have I. The question today is, has it been the right choice? Have you made the right analysis of who you're going to serve? Elijah suggested a process back then that would once and for all clarify which God was worth serving. The plan was to build two identical altars, prepare two identical sacrifices, and then let the contest begin. Let the duel start. Let the fight enter the ring. That was the plan. And so he said to them, "You call on the name of your God, and I will call on the name of the Lord. And the God who answers by fire, he is God." Fair? Now, these guys were very eager to accept this offer. Why? Well, as mentioned before, Elijah took the fight into the very heart of Baalism. This was their prime real estate territory, their place of worship. He was among their primary leaders, and the weapon that Elijah chose to fight with was their prime weapon. Baal was their sun god. He was their god of fire. And so basically Elijah said, "You got a god of fire? Great. Let's fight fire with fire. Let's see what your God has to deliver. Let him show his stuff. Let him prove his worth. Let him exercise and reveal his muscle. Let's see what he's made of." And I want to place the same challenge before you today. Who is your God? Who is it that you are tempted to serve? Who is it that is directing your life in the big and small things? And ask yourself this question. Are they big enough and strong enough to send the fire? Do they really bring the light and the heat that your soul longs for? Can they make the fire fall? You see, all of us have a desire for the power of God in our lives. But the question is, which one is going to make the fire fall? Which one is going to really bring us what we were fashioned to enjoy? And let me be very, very frank with you this morning as I talk this through. Is sex your God? Sex is one of the primary idols of our age. All over this world, people are bowing daily to the goddess of sex. Is that your God? Is that what drives you? Is that what motivates you? Is that what adjusts your time and your expenses and your thought life? If it is, choose it. Serve it. Go for it. But don't complain when your life collapses in disease, isolation, and heartbreaking loneliness. It'll light your fire for a while, but you'll always be wanting more fire, a bigger fire, a greater fire, because it can't deliver. The God is not big enough. And don't be shocked when you read the scientific evidence that proves that those with a deep faith in God and committed to heterosexual monogamous marriage, those people have the greater sex life. Proven scientific fact. Is beauty your God? Now, thankfully, we all try and make ourselves a little presentable. We have showers, we trim our beard, we put some makeup on, deodorant, hopefully. We do things. I'm not talking about general hygiene and basic stuff. But there are some people who are so captivated by this thing, they've just got to constantly make themselves more beautiful, going to unbelievable lengths to do so. That moves it into worship. It moves it into the idol stage. If you want to serve that, go ahead and serve it. But remember Halle Berry, one of the most beautiful Hollywood actresses right now. Just recently she was divorced, and she said she's concluded that her personal beauty means absolutely nothing. It's not worth making a goal of. Is your power and your position God? Some of you will sacrifice anything to get to the top. You'll maneuver, you'll scheme, you'll strategize, you'll sacrifice as long as you can get that next rung, that next position, that greater prestige. Is that what drives you? Go for it. But don't complain someday when you get to the top rung of the ladder only to realize that it's been leaning against the wrong wall. Is money your God? Is money your God? This ranks up there in our world today with sex as one of the prime idols. All over the world, people, including Christians, have this thing going on inside of us that if we just get a little more, then we'll be happy. Oh, really? How come the fire hasn't fallen with what you got? If stuff really would matter, if money really would satisfy, then how come we're not satisfied? We all have more than most of the people throughout history ever had, and we're probably the most unsatisfied generation in humanity. The God of money will always tickle you with flaming desire and then leave you ice cold inside. The Bible says very clearly, you cannot serve God and money. Can't do it. No man can serve two masters. No woman can walk two directions at the same time. And so we see the 450 priests of Baal trying every possible strategy to get their God of fire to show his stuff and to send fire. They prayed, they cried, they wailed, they burned incense, they prostrated themselves, they cut themselves with knives, they used every possible resource known to them to try and get their God to show his stuff. It didn't work. It came up dry. At the end of that, Elijah simply stepped up and prayed, O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel and that I am your servant and have done all these things at your command. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, so these people will know that you, O Lord, are God and that you are turning their hearts back again. Then the fire of the Lord fell and burned up the sacrifice, the wood, the stones, and the soil, and also licked up the water in the trench. When all the people saw this, they fell prostrate and cried, The Lord, He is God! The Lord, He is God! They didn't know the words, but they would have been singing, You are the famous one! You are the Lord of all the earth! We've seen it with our very own eyes. And those people on the mountain experienced what I experienced as a 10-year-old boy in that field. They realized there was a God who had the fire of His power. And He revealed it. Throughout my life, I've had the awesome privilege of seeing the fire of God fall in almost every possible human circumstance. I have watched the fire of God's power deliver drug addicts and set them totally free. I've watched Him deliver sex addicts and make them beautiful, holy, and pure people. I've watched God take marriages that were destined for the scrap heap and bring them back into intimate, loving relationships. I've watched parents watch their kids walk away into devastation, thinking they were irredeemable, and watch God rescue those children and bring them back and make them whole and bring the families back together. I've watched God heal bodies miraculously. I've watched God intervene in people's finances. Finances into that area where the world says, you can do it, you can do it. And God says, why don't you partner with me? Can I be honest with you and say I am surprised at how many professing believers say they worship God, the Lord of heaven and earth, and yet in reality our actions show that we're really